It's Al Cole welcoming you to another edition of my syndicated radio talk show. This week, my very special guest, very special lady, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderbergh. Nancy served in that venerable position between 1997 and 2001 under Bill Clinton. Nancy received also her bachelor's degree from Vanderbilt University and her master's from Georgetown University. She's an author and writes regularly on national security issues. She's the owner of Soderbergh Solutions. She's worked on four presidential campaigns. She's a distinguished visiting scholar at the University of Northern Florida. And she's a regular commentator on NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox, and the BBC, too, and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Nancy also speaks fluent French. Well, there, you know, so we're going to strap down here. We're going to mix foreign policy with diplomatic service, a couple of shakes of world peace, and a dash of romance here in a cuisine that is bon appetit and très bien. Could only happen to be tasted on It's All About Romance with Al Cole. Welcome, Nancy, to my show. It's my pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we even get into anything here, do you really speak fluent French, Nancy?
I do, actually. I studied it all in college and high school and ended up spending my junior year in France and have kept it up, both working at the United Nations. I travel to Africa regularly, and I try and find as many Haitian cab drivers as I can.
That's right. Clue me in here, because I just took a few years of French back in high school, like most of us. Bon appetit and très bien. Did I say it right?
You can roll the R in the back of your neck a little bit more.
I love that. Très bien. Nothing like French and that white wine going around. It's language of romance, and that's what we're all about here. It's all about romance with Al Cole. We're going to get into it. Nancy, fill us in. I mean, you know, impressive career here. Former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Fill us in a little bit about some of Nancy's experiences that led up to such a notable position.
Well, like many normal young women, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I started out as a marine biologist in college, got bored with that, decided to go to France, worked in a bank actually in Boston for a couple of years after that, and decided I knew I wanted to do something international, but not quite yet what. So I went to graduate school at Georgetown and thinking I would develop Africa or something. And this one pushy professor kept saying, you should go into politics. And I thought, oh, I hate politics. But I decided, why not try it? And that professor said, well, I'll get you a job. And I said, well, what do you know about politics? Thinking she was a nerdy professor that just had her nose in the book the whole time. And she goes, well, I'm the vice president. This is Mondale. And she got me my great job. I fell in love with politics. 10 years later, I'm working in the White House and then off as an ambassador. And that professor was Madeleine Albright.
Well, there.
She would go on, of course, to become the Secretary of State and just a wonderful public servant. So it was really quite a ride. And politics is an extraordinary way to get into changing the world and helping people. I've loved it.
That's right. Madeleine Albright, brilliant woman. I was always just impressed by the way that she presented herself. Brilliant and classy, too. And I congratulate you on having such a great college professor and a mentor. That way, somebody who guided you in the right direction. We're going to get into a lot of the experiences that you had as a U.S. ambassador to the U.N. But before we do, we're going to, you know, maybe give you a chance to talk a little bit about your books. You have a couple of books out there. You're an author.
I am, and the best line I've heard in terms of writing is Eudora Welty once was asked if she liked writing and paused and said, I like having written. It's wonderful to have books out, but for those of you who are thinking about it, don't underestimate how much time it takes. There are a lot of work, but my second book is called The Prosperity Agenda, What the World Wants from America and What We Need in Return. It came out in July of 2008. You can get it on Amazon. It's published by John Wiley, great publishing house in New York. And what it does is lay out how the United States must become a leader in solving the world's challenges as a way of rebuilding our trust in the world. And once we rebuild the trust, they'll help us solve our problems, which are making sure that terrorists don't get weapons of mass destruction and attack us again. Every one of these problems, debt, disease, environment, terrorism, non-proliferation, are global solutions. And this big debate that you heard recently between former Vice President Cheney and Obama of are we keeping ourselves safe, that if we need the rest of the world to do what we want, they're going to have to trust us. They don't, and we're going to have to rebuild that. And Obama understands that in a way that I think will keep us safe.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great to have Obama as president of the United States. You know, It's symbolic. It's symbolic. A lot of my listeners know I'm a black man myself, an African-American man, and we're proud. All people of the United States should be proud, African-Americans particularly. President Obama is putting out a great symbol, not only to America, but all around the world. It's hopeful. It's positively heading.
He's a great symbol, and people are hopeful, but it's going to be very hard for him to live up to the expectations that people have for him. We need to give him a little bit of time to get things right before starting to jump in and criticize him. But I think he understands the problems and the needs here at home and abroad to try and basically reorient the ship that we are, the superpower that we are, to try and put us on the right side of history, not just on the issue of terrorism and whether or not we should torture our own citizens or foreigners in trying to keep ourselves safe, but beyond that, the need to solve the global climate change issue, make sure that we tighten the nonproliferation system, and that we manage the globalization of our economy in a way that keeps us strong and growing, and make sure that we don't put up walls and shut ourselves down and throw ourselves into a worse economic situation.
Yeah, I agree. I agree, Nancy. It's an uphill battle here for President Obama. Nothing happens overnight. It's going to take time. We know that. It's great to have a sympathetic ear out there, however. We all, as Americans, appreciate that. Look forward to the next 4 years. Now, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. It's a big title here. What were some of your duties and a little day-to-day scheduling here? What happened? We're all curious. How did you go about doing your job?
Well, it's one of the best jobs in the world. First of all, you're representing the United States. And so even though I was, at the time, was a young woman in a sea of men, they all respect you because you represent the United States of America, and they know that. So you can go into a room and give a speech, and everyone listens. It's fun to sit around the Security Council table at the United Nations, raise your hand and vote, because everyone's wondering how you're going to vote. And in negotiating resolutions, you're up sometimes, you know, 1, 2 in the morning negotiating these things, because they all need the American in the room to do it. You get to travel around the world. I became an expert on peacekeeping, so I went to visit all the peacekeeping missions around the world. And lots of people don't know it, but the United Nations has the second largest deployed military in the world, over 130,000 people in various areas around the world trying to keep them stable and safe. And the United States does a lot to support those, so I would always go out and try and make sure that I understood the nuances of what the goals were. I remember getting off a plane one time. I was late 30s, maybe, looked about 30, and the aides come up to the plane, like, where's the ambassador? I'm like, here I am, here I am. And they were looking for somebody who was, they were expecting someone with gray hair and 60. So that was kind of fun. And it was just wonderful to represent the United States. The UN has a lot of problems, but it also has a lot of good things that you don't hear about. The bad things are the only ones that make news. It's eradicated polio around the world, immunized millions of children, saved hundreds of thousands of lives, negotiated the end to many, many wars around the world. It actually runs our air traffic control system. You wonder why every pilot doesn't have to speak French over France and Chinese over China. They all speak one language, use the same code. The UN runs that system, and it actually works. You don't really worry about flying internationally. So I've loved it and kept in touch with many of them. I still do some work with them, and it's just an extraordinary experience to represent the United States.
Yeah. What about Africa? You mentioned the children, immunizations, polio, eradication, all of those things are great. And then particularly Africa, we all know the horror stories. We all know what's going on with not only AIDS, but just hunger and children dying. How does the UN help out in Africa particularly?
Well, it houses, clothes, and protects millions of people all through Africa. It's in there trying to address the endemic diseases, HIV, AIDS. The U.S. has actually done quite a bit. One of the things that President Bush has gotten no credit for because of all the other problems is giving antiretroviral AIDS drugs to millions of people throughout Africa, and they appreciate it. Same with the Gates Foundation doing malaria. The real problem in Africa is the instability and the corruption that keeps the programs that the government should be ultimately running from being successful. One of my most vivid memories and horrible memories as being in Sierra Leone in the late 90s, where rebel groups backed by the neighboring Liberia would go around hacking off the limbs of women, children. And I remember holding a 2-year-old girl who had had both her arms amputated by these thugs. Oh. And it was the most, how could anybody be so inhumane? I also went to Rwanda right after the genocide and went to this church where you see just piles of hacked to death bodies. And you realize that the inhumanity and barbarity of the human nature just is always lurking under the surface. And leaders can unleash that in ways that are just horrifying. So leadership does matter around the world. And one of the things that the U.S. and the international community and the U.N. and others are trying to do is create a semblance of normalcy so the good leaders can rise, so you don't have these horrible wars. And it's women and children, for the most part, that suffer during those processes. The number of refugee camps that I've been in, you talk to women who are struggling. I remember being in Afghanistan talking to these women, and you know, I kept asking about the how can they stand wearing these burqas, and they're like, we don't care about the burqas. I care the fact that my husband died in the war, and I'm trying to feed, you know, 5 children. I have to live in my in-law's house where they treat me like a servant. And the UN is at the forefront of that. Good stories are very rarely reported, but they're out there, I guarantee you.
You know, when you're talking about some of the things that you were talking about, some of the diseases, devastation to human lives and personal devastations on individuals who just really don't deserve it. Jeanette Barber, who was the head writer and producer of the Rosie O'Donnell Show, was recently a guest on my show. She had just recently returned from Rwanda, and she was serving with a charitable organization out there. And she told me stories about men and women with teeth growing out of the area where the nose should be, and just heart-rending stories. It makes one want to weep.
Because their heads had been crushed, you mean?
Oh, my God.
Rwanda is a success story. The international community has come in and invested in it. They've got good leadership. Paul Kagame, who's the president there, has brought, believe it or not, high-tech centers to Rwanda. There's employment. They're growing. They're thriving. It has good leadership. And I think out of that horrible genocide came a commitment of the international community to help Rwanda rebuild in a way that has actually worked. So oddly, it's now a how to pick up yourself after one of those horrible, unimaginable disasters and give the next generation a better chance.
Absolutely. And even if we as individual Americans cannot help out by going to Rwanda or other places around the world and actively helping people, we can do it in our hearts, our souls, our minds. We can recondition ourselves to think in terms of sympathy for the human cause. Now, let's turn the corner here. When you were serving as U.S. ambassador to the U.N., along the same line that we've been talking about, now, gratifying accomplishments had to happen in that position. What were some of the most gratifying accomplishments in the tenure that you served?
Actually, I think the most gratifying came in my job before that, where I was the number 3 person on the National Security Council at the White House. I had worked for Clinton in the campaign in Little Rock, and he brought me with him to the White House. And I had worked for Ted Kennedy before that on a lot of the Irish peace processes. And little beknownst to me, I turned out to be the guy in the White House who knew the most about the Irish peace process.
Oh, no. Don't even sound Irish to me.
Well, my mother's half Irish, actually.
Really?
Mullen, but her mother was a Mullen from Boston, actually. When you work for Ted Kennedy, you get to know the entire Irish community. It turns out I actually did know a lot about it, and I had my antenna to the ground, and I could tell something was changing within the IRA, whereas the State Department, the FBI, the British all said, no, they're all thugs, don't negotiate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I could just tell through my contacts that something was changing, and Clinton was naturally inclined to get involved. And I ended up getting very involved in giving Gerry Adams a visa, getting him over here to try and help build up support for a ceasefire, and it worked. And today, there were about 200 or 300 people a year being killed in that violence in Northern Ireland. And we stopped the violence in the mid-1990s, and that sense of being able to convince the president to engage in a peace process that worked, and it's taken longer than I had hoped, but really changed that whole nature. And that's an amazing feeling. There are also times when you can intervene in smaller cases, getting people out of jail who might be killed, calling about a human rights case. When the White House calls, people listen. And it's also an extraordinary experience to jet set around the world with the President of the United States on Air Force One, and you get it, you jump in, and you're immediately with the head of the government and the president, and you meet the cream of the cultural and people in those cities, and so you get a bird's eye view of these countries, and you sense how powerful the United States is. The world wants the United States to engage.
Yeah, you had mentioned Bill Clinton in passing a couple of times there. What was it really like to work under President Bill Clinton? Give us the inside track here.
It was fabulous. Everyone thinks working in the White House is very glamorous, and I used to watch that show West Wing. I did some consulting with them, and the actual plots that they develop are pretty accurate, but nobody looks that good. You're exhausted, your nails aren't done, your hair's not done, the lights are bright, fluorescent, not those, table shadowy lights that they have on TV. But he's an extraordinary politician and a man who really wanted to change the world and left the country in very good shape economically, engaged himself very successfully in a variety of peace processes, and I think left a good legacy. Obviously, had a, I call it a Shakespearean tragic flaw with the various impeachment issues and those surrounding it, which tarnished it. But if you look at the record beyond that issue, it's a stellar one. He left George Bush, a country in very good shape when he turned over. He has managed to, since the president, develop a Clinton Global Initiative, which tries to get citizens involved in trying to change the world. He's now just been appointed the envoy to Haiti, so he's managed to stay very active afterwards. Yeah, it was just a privilege, and I'm a normal person who came from no connections or interest in politics whatsoever, and I encourage young women in particular to go into politics. You automatically are thrown into kind of the guy's world and learn the guy's tricks of how you get ahead and how you, it's necessary to kind of find out what's really going on, to listen, and you get catapulted into these extraordinary positions. I remember the first time I was in the Oval Office, Clinton had been in office maybe a couple of months, and we'd go in, on a regular basis. And the first time I really had sort of this out-of-body experience, he was sitting there on the phone with Yeltsin, the president of Russia, and I was on the other end taking notes of the phone, and I just had this out-of-body experience expecting someone to tap me on the shoulder and say, "You're in the wrong place."
Love it.
And you say, "Why? This normal person, what am I doing here?" And then all of a sudden you realize you know what you're doing, and then you realize you can do it, and it becomes surprisingly normal.
Yeah.
He's absolutely brilliant. He's got a soft side. He was always very nice when my family would come to visit the White House, and always send you little nice little notes, and just has a personal side that doesn't really come across publicly, as does Hillary. They're just very lovely people to work for.
You said that, well, maybe the warmth and personability of Bill Clinton doesn't come through to the public. I really think it does. I mean, the public has really acclimated themselves, gotten behind Bill Clinton.
He could have run for a third term if he had.
And he could have made it. I mean,
he would have won.
No question about it. My man is right out there. Bill Clinton, he's got that personality, even though, he went through certain scandals, even what he went through that was negative during his tenure as president, people still love him. And that's the point here. And, what former president would move to Harlem after after being a president? Bill Clinton's got personality, and I'm all about that. And it's all about romance with Al Cole. You also said something else about out-of-body experiences that I love, Nancy. You're in the right place for it here. We talk about some of these things now. We're going to put it in a way that's going to be easy for you to talk about it. In-or-body experiences that have to do with compassion, that have to do maybe with spirituality. When you were serving as U.S. ambassador to the U.N., what are some of the real humbling experiences that you had, and how did it humble you just overall as a human being, even spiritually elevated you? Fill us in on this.
I think that the humbling experience was when I was trying to get confirmed for this job. I got caught up in the campaign financing scandals that happened in between Clinton's two terms. And because I was the point person at the White House for the Democratic National Committee, the Republicans who were trying to investigate Clinton for sneaking Chinese donors in and out of the White House pinpointed me as the one who must have been involved in that. And of course, first of all, it wasn't happening, and secondly, I didn't do it. But the minute you get, you know, served with a subpoena to go to a grand jury, you are guilty until proven innocent. It takes a year. So I sat around for a year waiting for this investigation to be cleared up. And it's the first time your integrity and your judgment is questioned. And it's just devastating. And in fact, it was great because this is one of the reasons people love Ted Kennedy. He called me in the middle of that and said, "How you doing?" And of course, I burst into tears. "It's horrible." And he just sat there on the phone for half an hour talking to me about how many bad things had happened to him and how you think everyone's staring at you and how you just go on. And I said, 2 years from now, you'll laugh about this. And I said, "I don't think so." And of course, he was right. You eventually get through it, as everyone does, and I had a wonderful time. But it's the first time anybody had questioned your judgment. It's the most humbling. Since I'm always fascinated by these, you know, investigations of people who, you know, there's a lot of press when you start out on these investigations, and in the end, when you're exonerated, you get absolutely no notice, no credit, and you're not expected to be mad about it. And of course, everyone's furious about it. So it's probably the most daunting thing to get. You're so powerless. There's nothing you can do. I'm always wanting to fix things. Okay, how can I fix this? And you can't. So of course, a year later, it worked out, but probably the oddest thing. The other is just in negotiations of how powerless so many people are around the world. And it's humbling when you meet someone who has the courage to try and challenge those systems, or you meet someone who comes out of jail for 30. I met Nelson Mandela when he had been out of jail maybe a month. And, you know, I said, "Aren't you kind of annoyed? I mean, angry?" And there's this serenity about them that is humbling that I think, I'm not sure I could do that. And you realize the strength of human character in people who are just downright extraordinary. And I would meet people who'd come out of jail, you know, wrongly imprisoned in Russia or China or, you know, Ireland, anywhere that, you know, they'd come and be supported by the human rights activist community in Washington. And you meet these people, and it is absolutely humbling because I always wonder, you know, how would I react if I were in that? Individuals who don't have the powerful ear of the United States president, you can call up and say, "Can you get me out of jail, please?" You know, and you realize that the people who are out there that don't have that voice. And so it's a very humbling experience.
Isn't that something? You know, and humbling experiences, correct me if I'm wrong here, can lead us to spiritual elevation. They can make us better men and women in this world. Am I on the right track there, Nancy?
Absolutely. I mean, you go through personal tragedies or traumas and you think, you know, you curl up in a fetal position and think you're never going to get out of it. And then people out of nowhere will come and help you through a very difficult period, people you don't even know that well. And you begin to think this is not a coincidence. There's a greater being out there that's out there for you when you really need it. And you do get spiritual about those things, no question about it.
That's right. What are some of Nancy's messages to women out there to help empower them in their relationships, in their everyday lives?
Well, first of all, find mentors. You cannot do it on your own. It's a man's world out there, and don't ever forget it. And you need to learn how to navigate that world through a network of both men and women. Women tend to not be great about helping other women at high places because they're used to being the only women on the block and their cat claws come out. I've seen it many, many times. Working on campaigns is a great equalizer because the men and women are thrown into this environment and everybody does well and fails at the same equal ratio. So get mentors, ask questions, ask for help. I'm a big proponent of internships. If you've worked in an office, they're more likely to hire you. Go to graduate school. Don't worry about how you're going to pay for it. Lots of people go to graduate school with no money, but you need those extra degrees. Law degrees are great. I have a master's, not a law degree, and I've done fine, but for women who are willing to go to law school, it's a great equalizer, rightly or wrongly. If you have a law degree, people assume you're smart and will pay you more. Don't try and be a super mom. You can't have kids and work in high-powered jobs and have a happy life and a balanced life. You need to have some give and take. sequence yourself a little bit, choose a partner that understands your own goals, that you intend to have a full career, and that means that everything has to be shared equally. Have those conversations before you decide any permanent relationships like that, and make sure you take care of yourself. Women are always the ones who are making everything work for everybody else, and tend not to, you know, you need to put those barriers around and say, this is what I need to be successful, and don't let anybody cross that. Make sure you have a lot of girlfriends too. I mean, the number of times I've needed to talk for hours to my sister or my girlfriends, you need sounding boards. And I think more than men, for some reason, men don't need that as much as women, or else they hold it in tight, or maybe that's why they have heart attacks earlier.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, one of the reasons men don't appear to need it as much. Men, being a man, I think I can say, yeah, men need that too. But men get it from early ages, that camaraderie with other kids, playing football, playing baseball, getting involved in Boy Scouts, getting involved in this, in that. And sometimes the younger girls don't have the same outlets. Now, you know, these days, more and more. But of course, people 35 and over who are growing up, sometimes they didn't have the same sorts of outlets. And the men have developed that sort of camaraderie. One of the things that I always suggest to women is, look, get involved with other women. Talk to other women. Find out what's on other women's minds. That can clue you into a great direction to be able to empower your own life. It's a very, very important thing. And one of the reasons I talk like this is because I have a great mom, a great mother, who taught me how to respect women. And I have a great father who taught me how to respect romance and treating women with the dignity that they deserve. So women deserve all of the dignity.
They're afraid if they stand up for what they need, they won't have the relationship continue.
Yeah.
You can't stand up for what you need and have your partner respond. You're in the wrong relationship.
That's right.
And I think women are afraid to do that. And I'm also, I say this to both men and women, I do a mentoring program here in Jacksonville for students who are largely underprivileged and don't know that there's a broader community out there. And I get university students here into internships and others. And, you know, I always say to them, if you don't feel in your gut that it's the coolest thing in the world and you want to do, then do something different. You listen to your gut. Your body and your mind knows what's right for you, and listen to that little voice inside you. And if it says, something doesn't feel quite right here, always, always listen to that. It's never wrong.
That's right. Not only listen to your inner voice, but know, women, that you can be equal. And don't be afraid to speak your mind. Don't be afraid to show that you have something on your mind that is worthy of that sort of respect.
It'll come out somehow, so you might as well be upfront about it.
You got it. You got it. We have a few minutes left here, Nancy. Before I ask you for your links, how people can contact you, let me ask you this. What kind of world would you envision over the next decade or so, and how would you mold that world?
Well, I actually think it's what Obama's trying to do, and I think he won't get everything that he wants, but I think if you fast forward where we'll be in 10 years, I think Obama will have an 8-year term. Two 4-year terms, 8 years. So hopefully he'll pass it off to another Democratic candidate in 12 years. But, you know, for take the next 10 years. I think here at home, I do think we'll get universal health care. I was talking to some friends in Senator Kennedy's office actually the other day, and they're very optimistic that they'll be able to get the legislation through, which will keep Americans healthier and keep our costs down. I do think the stimulus package that President Obama is implementing will work. My guess is it's probably not going to be enough, and they're going to have to do it again. The economy is much worse than anybody anticipated, but I think it ultimately will get America back to work and work. How we pay that back is going to depend on how fast we come back and how fast we can grow. So I think at home it's a good story. What we need to fend off are these really extremist views that get promoted around on some of the cable networks news that makes us want to kick out the immigrants and shut down, be not the open society that we have, this whole false debate that we have a crisis in immigration because 12 million Mexicans come here to take jobs that no Americans want, is a problem in not giving enough visas to make that a humane system and to throw them all out. So I think we have some challenges in that respect to fend off the voices of extremism. And I think we need to stand up and push back on the networks that put them on television and in our own communities. Internationally, it's a little bit trickier. I think Iraq will work at great cost to American in terms of blood and treasure, which will be debated whether it was worth it forever. I think Afghanistan and Pakistan will be very dangerous places for some time to come. Unless we invest in a 20-year development program there, we're going to have problems there. We're already hearing voices of when are we going to get out of both places. We can't get out. We're there for the long haul. Russia, I think, will probably continue to be a problem. China, I think, will be less of a problem. It's growing. It's expanding. It's going to end up being an economic competitor, but not a political or military competitor. Latin America's doing well. Europe's doing well. So overall, I think you'll see prosperity expanding around the world. For young people coming up, learn Chinese. They're the next economic competitor. We want to change them. Go into those high-tech science jobs, the green jobs. Like it or not, manufacturing is moving overseas, and while we can keep some of it here, and we should, I think the large jobs for Americans are going to be in high-tech professional jobs, so go to graduate school, learn international languages. Every company today is international. If you have a website, you have an international company. Anybody can find you. And so, learn languages, travel, recognize you're a citizen of the world, and get that graduate degree, and then you'll be fine.
That's great. You know, words of wisdom, future direction here from Nancy Soderbergh. We've been listening to her, really marveling at your experience as former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Nancy, before we leave you, give us your links.
My website is nancysoderbergh.org. So it's nancysoderbergh.org. It's got two books. You can get an Amazon Prosperity Agenda from last summer, and the first book, The Superpower Myth, came out in 2005, and it sort of summarizes Clinton and Bush's approach to the foreign policy challenges. I'm teaching here in Jacksonville, Florida, and I'm up in D.C. and New York and travel quite a bit, so the best place to reach me is my website.
Great show, Nancy. And it's with Al Cole, syndicated nationally, internationally. Thank you again, Nancy. It's been my pleasure.
My pleasure.